Now the negatives, Cappy said, when the prints had been reduced to ash. I removed the strips of negatives and held them to the blaze. The film flared and disappeared, leaving an acrid odor in the air. Once the photographs and negatives had been destroyed, I didn't think the three of us would be in jeopardy. Cappy was currently on parole, already in serious violation because of the firearm he was waving around. Why would he add to his troubles? He had nothing to gain and everything to lose if he used the gun against us. We were no threat to him. Even if we blabbed about the photographs, the proof was gone. I maintained a cautious silence nonetheless, not wanting to set him off. He glanced at me, saying, "Kick the ashes around and make sure nothing's left." I used the toe of my boot to nudge the residue of burned photographic paper. One sheet had retained its soft, rectangular shape, and I could have sworn a shadowy image remained. Len and Cappy, features blurred and nearly indistinct. The fragments separated and tumbled soundlessly around the logs. Cappy got up and tucked the gun in the waist of his jeans at the small of his back. Now that the evidence had been reduced to soot, he seemed relaxed, ready to get on with his evening's entertainment. "You folks sit tight and I'll be on my way. I appreciate your cooperation," he said, showing what an affable fellow he was. He must have seen the movies featuring crooks with good manners. Dodie wept. She had a hand across her eyes, the tears coursing down her cheeks. She remained motionless, carefully suppressing any audible sobs. Cappy proffered his good nights and ambled to the door. He had a thug's sense of dignity to uphold, and he didn't want to leave us with the impression he was fleeing the scene. He must have been as relieved as I was that his mission had gone smoothly. Pinky hadn't moved a muscle, and I was holding my breath, conscious the situation wouldn't be resolved until Cappy was in his car and driving away. He opened the front door and went out, closing it behind him with an insolent smile. Pinky screamed, "Son of a bitch!" He was instantly on his feet. He tore out of the living room and into the hall, where he yanked open the closet door and hauled items off the shelf in a tumble until he had his gun in hand. He checked the load and smacked the magazine into place while he ran to the door and flung it open, screaming Cappy's name. I was right behind him, trying desperately to keep him under control. Cappy was halfway across the street, and when he turned, Pinky snapped off three shots, the muzzle kicking up each time. I heard a high-pitched shriek, but it was the sound of outrage instead of pain. Cappy hadn't been hit, but he was shocked at Pinky's audacity. He was apparently unaccustomed to being a target, and the reality made him sound as shrill as a girl. He pulled the gun from the small of his back and fired twice before he turned and raced away down the street, elbows pumping, his running shoes thumping on the pavement. A moment later, I heard his car door slam and the engine catch. In his haste, he banged into the car in front of him before he cleared the space and took off. Pinky was panting, his own breathing hoarse with rage and adrenaline. I looked back at Dodie, thinking she'd flattened herself on the floor so she could use the easy chair for cover. Then I saw the blood. One of Cappy's rounds had ripped through the frame wall, which slowed the trajectory of the bullet, but not by much. It was my turn to shriek with surprise, but the sound was reduced to one of simple disbelief. Pinky froze, taking in the sight of her. He couldn't seem to grasp her condition from the evidence in front of him. As with me, it was the blood that finally registered. He scrambled to her side and turned her over onto her back. She'd caught the bullet in her chest on the right-hand side. It looked like her clavicle was shattered, and blood oozed dully from the wound. Pinky pressed both his hands over the area, and his face turned up to mine in helplessness and horror. I skittered out of the room and headed down the hall to the kitchen, where I snatched the handset from the wall-mounted phone and hit 911. When the dispatcher picked up, I gave her the bare bones, the nature of the emergency, and the location where the shooting had taken place. I put a hand over the mouthpiece and called to Pinky. Hey, Pinky, what's your street address? He hollered out the number, which I conveyed to her. The dispatcher was methodical, repeating her questions in a matter-of-fact fashion, until she was satisfied with the information I'd provided. In the background, I could hear a second dispatcher take another call. The woman I was talking to broke off long enough to initiate the emergency response, launching aid and assistance. When I returned to the living room, the first thing I spotted was Pinky's gun lying on the floor. With an ambulance on the way to the shooting scene, that was the last thing we needed to be dealing with. I picked up the gun and went out to the hall, where the floor was still littered with the stuff he tossed out in his haste to find his weapon. I didn't have the time or inclination to tidy up, so I did the next best thing, which was to return to the living room and stash the gun under a couch cushion. Pinky saw me doing it, but neither of us wanted to worry about searching for a better hiding place. St. Terry's was less than 4 blocks away, which worked in our favor. I knelt beside Pinky, and we did what we could for Dodie, whose chest was heaving. She was already trembling from shock and blood loss. I'm not sure she had any idea what had happened, but her complexion was pasty, and her system was reacting with a series of shudders. I patted and coaxed and reassured her while Pinky babbled whatever comfort and encouragement came to mind. It was the language of alarm and stress. Hysteria kept under control by sheer necessity. In that one instant, everything had gone wrong. With the photographs burned, I thought the worst had passed, but it had only begun. I watched Dodie with a curious sense of detachment. She was conscious, and while she had no way to assess her situation, she knew she was in trouble. I believe that in such circumstances, a victim can decide whether to choose life or to let it go. Whatever the severity of her wound, we could talk her into staying with us if she accepted what we said, which was she was fine. She was okay, that she'd make it. Help was coming, that she was doing great, that we were with her. It was a litany of life-affirming promises, a pledge that she was safe, that she'd be whole again, fully mended, and without pain. She was teetering on the brink, the abyss opening up before her. I watched her look down into the dark hole of death, and then her eyes rolled back into her head. I gave her hand a shake. She opened her eyes again and looked from my face to Pinky's. A message passed between them, silent and intent. If he was capable of calling her back, I knew he was doing so. The question was whether she was capable of responding to his plea. I heard sirens, and moments later saw lights flashing beyond the living room windows. I left Pinky with Dodie and went to the door, waving my arms as though that might hurry them along. The miracle of emergency personnel is the calm response to situations that would otherwise disintegrate into chaos. There were 4 of them, all men and younger than seemed possible, a team of children with all the optimism of skill and training. 4 strong boys rising to the occasion. I could see Dodie taking in the sight of their faces, caring and kind. Even Pinky seemed soothed as they tended to the immediate first aid measures, pulse, blood pressure. 1 put in an IV line and another administered oxygen. The 4 of them wrapped her in blankets and lifted her onto the gurney. It was a practiced and smoothly coordinated effort, and she seemed to give up her confusion and surrender to their care, as though reduced to infancy. As soon as she was out the door, I put an arm around Pinky's shoulder, which was both solid and oddly bony, a small man in a protective armor of muscle. As we emerged from the house, I noticed that his next-door neighbors had turned off their lights, not wanting to be roped in. I walked Pinky to my car and let him in on the passenger side. I made sure he was reaching for his seatbelt, so I wouldn't slam his fingers in the door. I went around to my side and slid in under the wheel. I turned the key in the ignition, put the car in drive, and eased away from the curb. I thought I was speeding, but the car seemed to move at a crawl as I covered the distance from Pinky's apartment to the hospital. There was no conversation between us, though I reached for his hand at one point and squeezed. The ambulance had reached the ER ahead of us. I dropped Pinky at the door and told him I'd find parking. Dodie's gurney disappeared through the sliding doors in a rolling flutter of white coats. She'd been swallowed up, leaving him behind. By the time I pulled into the nearby lot and scavenged the closest possible parking spot, my composure was fading, and my heart had started to thunder. I grabbed my bag from the trunk and then jogged the half block back. The reception area was bright with overhead lights, and the waiting room was empty. Pinky was sitting in a glass cubicle with a woman in civilian clothing who was typing information onto a form, filling in the blanks as Pinky provided answers. I took a seat, keeping an eye on the two until she'd finished with him. He looked miserable as he left the cubicle and plodded to the front door. I followed, watching as he sank to the steps outside with his head between his knees. I sat down beside him and we waited. It felt like 2 in the morning, but when I looked at my watch, it was only 8:35. This was a Tuesday night, and I was guessing the emergency room personnel had been enjoying a respite from the usual weekend onslaught of injured and half-dead. I pictured cuts and bloody noses and allergic reactions, food poisoning, heart attacks, broken bones. Also, the host of minor illnesses that by rights should have been relegated to the nearest clinic the next day. We were lucky Dodie wasn't having to compete for attention. Wherever they'd taken her, I knew she was in good hands. I got up and went inside, where the aide, a young black guy in scrubs, was sitting at the desk. I said, "Hi, I'm wondering if you could tell us anything about Dodie Ford, who was brought in by ambulance a few minutes ago. Her husband's been filling out the paperwork, and I know he'd appreciate word." "I can check." He got up and crossed to the double doors that opened onto the medical bays in back. The glimpse I caught of the interior showed 2 empty gurneys with the curtains pushed back along the tracks laid in the ceiling. There was medical apparatus at the ready, but no sign of nurses or doctors and no sense of hubbub. The aide closed the door behind him and returned in less than a minute. "They're taking her up to surgery. The doctor will be out in a bit. Sorry, I can't tell you more. I'm telling you what they told me." I went outside and gave Pinky the paltry information I'd been given. I was wearing my windbreaker, but the fabric was light, and I might as well have done without. He'd gone through 4 cigarettes, lighting each from the one he was about to stub out. I said, "Why don't we go inside? I'm about to freeze to death out here." "They won't let me smoke in there." I didn't have the energy to argue, and I didn't want him sitting by himself. I resumed my seat, tucking my hands between my knees for warmth. Beside me, he sighed and hung his head, shaking it back and forth. "My fault. Shit, shit, shit. This is all my fault. I should have left well enough alone." "Pinky, don't get into that. It's not going to help." "But why'd I go after him? That's what I'm asking myself. It was over and done. And if I'd have kept my cool, he'd have been gone." "You want to talk about it? Fine. If it's going to make you feel any better, I'm listening." "I don't want to talk about it. Anything happens to her, I'm going to kill that prick. Swear to God I am." "Dodie's in good hands." He turned and looked at me. "How am I going to pay for her care? You should have heard what the lady in there was asking me. And what was I supposed to say? We got no insurance, no credit, no savings, nothing in the checking account. Dodie's hurt bad, and we're racking up thousands in medical bills. She hasn't been in here an hour, and I'm already in the poorhouse. She's bound to be laid up, which means no income for her. I'm an ex-con. I can't get a job for shit. And look at all the other bills we got. How will those get paid? I'm sure there's some form of financial assistance through the county, I said. I don't want handouts. Me and her are proud. We're not deadbeats. We've just been down on our luck, and now we're totally sunk. I kept my mouth shut and let him ramble. Dodie's fate was unknown. He didn't dare assume she'd live, and he couldn't own up to the fact that she might just as easily die. He was superstitious enough to avoid talk about either possibility, lest he tip the scales. Instead, he focused on the financial upheaval, which he was equally ill-equipped to deal with. He must have felt safer thinking about the bills he'd be facing, which were at least concrete and more nearly in his control than Dodie's perilous state. I crossed my arms, hunching over to keep warm, thinking he could just as easily give vent to his worries in the hospital waiting room. He never once mentioned running out on his obligations, but his fretting was self-perpetuating. I felt like a Hallmark card when I suggested he deal with his troubles one day at a time. What was this, a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, let's talk about something else. He was silent, still brooding. You know how all this started, don't you? I shook my head. With Audrey Vance. Audrey? Yeah, I thought you must have figured it out. I was there the day of her arrest. I borrowed Dodie's Cadillac late afternoon to take a little spin and got busted on a DUI. Audrey was brought in about the same time. You knew her? Oh, sure. Her and me go way back. I did a couple of jobs for her, and don't ask what, because I'm taking that to my grave. Did you talk to her? He shook his head. I only seen her in passing, so I never had a chance. Next day, she called in a panic because of what she witnessed that night. Which was what? When she came out of the station after her boyfriend posted bail, there sat Cappy in a parked car with Lan. She knew who he was because she worked for his brother. Didn't take a rocket scientist to know Cappy was on the police payroll, telling Pretty everything he knew. She knew she was dead meat if he realized she'd seen them together. Guess he must have done just that, or she'd still be here. So, who threw her off the bridge? Who do you think? Cappy? Of course. He had to shut her up or she'd have told Dante. Pretty may be corrupt, but he wouldn't go that far. Yet. Anyway, subject closed. I shouldn't have led on, but I figured you must be concerned how I'd get caught up with the likes of him. I did wonder, I said. That asshole Cappy's not going to get away with this. I get my hands on him. He's dead. If he's on the run, he might leave the state. You don't even know where he is. I can sure as shit find out. I got street connections, and I know where he lives. A guy like him can't disappear. He's not smart enough. He couldn't even get a job on his own. He's reduced to working in his brother's warehouse. That's how he gets the lowdown on all the stuff he's passing to the cops. Just stay out of it. Oh, no. No, no. He's not getting off that easy. I got ways to get even. You can't afford to get even. You'll only make things worse. You don't know worse. I know worse. I had to plug him full of holes and let him see how it feels. Come on, Pinky. I can understand you're wanting revenge, but that'll put you back in prison, and then what? Dodie's in trouble. She needs you. It's self-indulgent to brood about striking back when you've got more important issues to worry about. Leave them to the police. After I get through, they can have them. Forget that and focus on Dodie. I think we should hold good thoughts just in case it helps. I am focused on Dodie. That's the point. What he did to her, he pays for, plain and simple. I gave up. The more I argued, the more determined he became. No point in fueling his rage by putting up resistance. At 9 o'clock, he agreed to go inside, and it was nearly 11 when the surgeon finally appeared. Judging from his ID tag, he was foreign-born, with a surname I wouldn't know how to pronounce. I took one look at his face and left the two of them to confer. I wanted to hear what the doctor had to say, but it seemed tacky to listen in. As I watched Pinky's expression change, the news probably wasn't good. As soon as the surgeon departed, Pinky sank into a chair and wept. I sat down beside him and patted his back. I didn't think she'd died, but I was afraid to ask. So I simply murmured and patted and waited him out. The woman at the desk saw what was going on, and she appeared with a box of tissues. Pinky grabbed a handful and mopped at his eyes.
Sorry. Oh, man. I'm not long for this world.
What did the doctor say?
I don't know. He had an accent so thick I couldn't understand a word. The minute he started talking, it was like I went deaf because I was so afraid he'd have bad news.
Is she going to be okay?
Too early to tell, or at least that's what I think he said. He didn't seem all that happy, and when he threw in all that medical gobbledygook, my ears went out on me. His eyes were so sad, I nearly busted up right then. I think he said he'd know better in the next 12 hours or some amount of time. She's been moved to ICU. I can stay if I want.
Talking seemed to help, and by the time he'd pulled himself together, I felt like I was on the verge of collapse myself. Of course, Pinky opted to spend the night in the waiting room down the hall from ICU. I wanted to stay as well, but he urged me to go home. It didn't take much in the way of persuasion. I told him I'd get in a few hours' sleep and check with him in the morning to see how she was doing. Before I left, I volunteered to go down to the cafeteria and buy a couple of cups of coffee, for which he seemed grateful. I was the only one who seemed to be wandering the halls. I knew the location of the cafeteria from other occasions. The place would be closed, but I remembered a row of vending machines that would be humming with choices. When I reached the corridor, I took out two singles from my wallet and slid the bills into the slot one by one. I punched a button for coffee, punched a second button to add cream, and picked up some sugar packets from a small cart nearby that stocked napkins and wooden stir sticks. I paid for a second coffee and carried the two styrofoam cups with me back to the ER. As I reached the waiting room, I saw a black and white pull into one of the parking spaces outside the entrance. An officer got out of the car and came in through the sliding doors, glancing at Pinky in passing. I did an about-face and remained in the hall while the mini-drama played out. I knew how it would go. The cop would ask the desk clerk for the victim's name and next of kin. He'd be directed to Pinky, after which he'd quiz him for however long it took to complete a detailed report about the shooting. I didn't want to participate. I was tired. I felt itchy and out of sorts, and too impatient to put up with an interview. I'd be happy to tell the cops what I knew, but not right then. In any event, the officer would leave his business card with Pinky in case he thought of anything he wanted to add. I'd get his name from Pinky and go into the station in the morning. If he was off duty, someone else would take my statement. I peered into the waiting room where the two sat in one corner, Pinky slumping forward, talking with his head in his hands, while the officer took notes. I dumped the two cups of coffee in a trash bin and found an exit in another wing. The walk to the parking lot was longer but worth every step. I retrieved my car and drove home through the dark, deserted streets. I turned up the heat in the Mustang until it felt like an incubator, and I still couldn't get warm. Once home, I crawled under the covers without bothering to undress. In the morning, I skipped my run. After I'd showered and dressed and downed my usual bowl of cereal, I pulled out the telephone book and looked for Lorenzo Dante's name. There was no home address given, but I spotted a listing for Dante Enterprises, which was located downtown in the Passages Shopping Plaza.
Though it was strictly in the none-of-your-business category, I thought it was time to bring Cappy's brother into the equation. I had no idea what the relationship was between the two, but if Cappy wasn't going to take responsibility for what he'd done, then maybe his brother would step up to the plate. With a police report now on file, the judicial system would grind into gear, eventually pulling Cappy into its maw. His parole officer would file a notice with the parole board, and he'd be picked up and detained until a Morrissey hearing could be held. As the shooter, he'd be entitled to counsel, and would be accorded any number of constitutional rights. Meanwhile, Doty, as victim, had no rights at all. If Cappy's parole was revoked, he'd be sent back to prison, while Doty would be sent into a rehab facility for a long, slow, and painful period of recovery, assuming she survived. Pinky would pay a stiff price either way, and that didn't sit right with me. I drove into the underground parking garage that ran the length of the shopping center. Stores weren't yet open, so all of the parking spaces were available. I chose one at the far end of the lot, close to the elevators. I ran an eye down the wall-mounted directory, which listed the companies with offices on the second and third floors above the retail establishments. Dante Enterprises occupied the penthouse suite. I took the elevator up. I don't know what I expected from the digs of a loan shark, but the complex was elegant and beautifully furnished, with pale gray shortcut pile carpeting and interior walls of glass and high-gloss teak. The reception desk was empty, and I waited, not quite sure what to do with myself. I took a seat on a lush gray leather chair and leafed through a magazine with one eye on the elevator. Finally, the doors opened, and a tall, balding man wearing glasses emerged and crossed to the inner door, pausing with his hand on the knob. "Is someone helping you?" I set the magazine aside and stood up. "I'm looking for Lorenzo Dante, the younger one. I understand there are two." "You have an appointment?" I shook my head. I was hoping he could see me. I just took a chance he'd be in. "He's usually here by now, but I didn't see his car in the garage. Is this something I can help you with?" "I don't think so. It's a private matter. Do you have any idea what time he'll be in?" The man checked his watch. "Should be soon. If you take a seat, I can have the receptionist bring you a cup of coffee while you wait." By then, I was feeling anxious, suddenly uncertain what I was doing there and what I hoped to accomplish. I can tattle with the best of them, but I prefer to do so when I know my audience. Here, I had no idea what sort of reception to expect. "You know what? I think I'll run a couple of errands and come back in a bit."
"If you change your mind about the coffee, let the receptionist know," he said.
He disappeared into the inner corridor just as the receptionist came out and returned to her desk. I had already moved to the elevator where I pressed the down button. I was intent on exiting before Dante showed up, so it was only by chance that I glanced back at her as she took her seat. She noticed I was staring at her, and she gave me the blank look of someone who hasn't yet registered what's going on. I said, "Aren't you Abby Upshaw?" Still the blank look. "Yes. I'm Kinsey Milhone. I met you the other day at lunch. You're Len Pretty's girlfriend." Her gaze locked on mine, and I could see her formulate the recollection of who I was and where we'd met. It dawned on her that I was a friend of Chaney Phillips's, and someone who knew more about her than I should. I was still putting the pieces together, but I'd already gotten the picture. It was her house Pinky had broken into when he stole Len's packet of pictures. She'd probably taken the photographs herself, documenting the link between the vice detective and Dante's brother. What I knew, without even asking, was that she'd been planted in Dante's office to pick up the same sort of inside dope that Cappy was spilling to the cops. I heard a soft ping. The elevator doors opened, and I stepped in. She watched, transfixed,
as the doors slid shut. She was pale, and her expression had turned from fear to dread. It was a moment I enjoyed perhaps more than I should have. Chapter 29. Dante. In the rear of the limousine, Dante donned his reading glasses while he studied the spreadsheet Saul had sent to the house by messenger the night before. This was a comprehensive view of his finances, pages he'd shred when he'd absorbed the content. He'd meant to go over the report when it first arrived, but he was distracted by the revelation from Nora's offhand remark at the beach house that day. He wondered if there was any way he could have known she'd been married to Trip Lanahan, of all people. Dante could count on the fingers of one hand men who'd come to his defense. Trip had seen value in him, had successfully challenged bank policy for him, an unprecedented gesture of trust and confidence. Trip had also taken a raft of shit from the bank for approving the loan, but he'd shrugged off the criticism and stuck to his guns. Dante was never sure why he'd done it, but it meant the world to him. In his mind, buying the big old house made him almost respectable, and he'd never missed a payment. In fact, he'd paid it off 6 years early and now owned it free and clear. Since then, he'd worked hard to erase the taint of gangsterdom that dogged his days. It was a reputation he couldn't seem to shake. He was tired of the burden and tired of trying to free himself from the power struggles and the necessity for domination. Until recently, when he'd pictured his escape, it was always in the vague and cloudy future. It had helped immensely to know he had a way out. But now that the reality loomed before him, he was reluctant to act. It would make all the difference if Nora agreed to go with him. But what were the chances once she knew the part he'd played in Philip's death? He was doomed if he stayed and doomed if he left without her. Uncle Alfredo was another loss he wasn't ready to face. Alfredo loved him as his father never had. And even with his life slipping away, he was Dante's anchor. Dante couldn't imagine leaving while the man could still draw breath. Then there was the end of his relationship with Lola, and that depressed him as much as anything. That morning, when he'd finished showering and getting dressed, he'd come into the bedroom to find her already up and in her travel clothes. She had a suitcase open on the bed and a garment bag hooked over the open closet door with the inner flap unzipped. She'd already moved a number of dresses, skirts, and suits still on hangers into its interior. "What's this about? What's it look like? I'm packing my things." "You don't have to leave so soon." "Of course I do. The whole world doesn't revolve around you. I have needs and desires of my own." "Where are you going?" "Haven't decided yet. I'm having a car take me down to Los Angeles. I'll stay at the Bel Air until I make up my mind. London, for sure, and after that, who knows?"
"You need cash?"
"No, Dante. I have a fortune in gold coins stashed under the mattress. I thought you knew."
He smiled in spite of himself. "How much?"
$50,000 should do for now."
He took out his money clip and counted off a number of bills that he handed to her. "That's 10. I'll have Luell get the other 40 to you at the hotel. After that, she'll set up an account for you."
"Thanks. I'm charging everything to you anyway, but there's always tips and incidentals. You might alert American Express, so there's no hassle. I hate when the assholes refuse a card. They're always so smug about it."
"No problem."
He sat down on the edge of the bed, which was still unmade. The covers were thrown back, and the sheets were warm with her scents. Cologne, bath salts, shampoo. He felt a sharp pang of anxiety. What would he do with himself when she was gone? After 8 years, he couldn't even picture the empty place she'd leave in his life. She secured the elastic bands across the hanging clothes to hold them flat, and then closed and zipped the inner flap. She added a few items to the big suitcase and closed that as well.
Could you haul that down for me? I don't want to give myself a hernia. He crossed to the closet door and lifted the garment bag off by its hook. He placed it on the bed and watched while she zipped it up. This is all you're taking? Doesn't look like much. I gotta be prepared to tote everything myself. The bags have wheels, but there's a limit to how many I can manage at one time. Well, that's what red caps and bellboys are for. Only when I get where I'm going. In between, I got cabs and airports and who knows what. Better to travel light so I don't end up loaded down like a pack mule, she said. What about you? I figured you'd be taking off with your new lady love. What's her name? Nora. How'd you find out about her? I know how you operate, and I can get information from the same sources. She hasn't agreed to go with me. And now, something else has come up. Uh-oh. That doesn't sound good. It's not. 2 years ago, I loaned a kid some money on a gambling debt. He owed a casino in Vegas, and he came to me for cash to cover him. We made a deal and shook hands. I ponied up, and then he tried to weasel out of paying. He offered me his Porsche in lieu of payment, and I told Cappy to take care of it. I meant take a look and see if the car was okay. Cappy tossed him off the parking garage. I take it Cappy didn't get caught or he'd still be locked up, she said. That's not the problem. Turns out the kid was Nora's only son. I knew her husband years ago, Trip Lanahan. Guy drops dead of a heart attack at 36. She mentions his name and I put it together in a flash. I thought I'd have a heart attack myself. Lola sat down beside him. What are you going to do? What are my choices? I have to tell her. No, you don't. Are you nuts? Keep your big mouth shut. Otherwise, all you're going to do is fuck it up. What if she hears about it from someone else? Then I'm really fucked. Lola's expression was pained. Oh, please. You know what this is like? Having an affair and then making a full confession. Leaves the guilty party feeling just fine, thanks. You get it off your chest, and your conscience is clear. Meanwhile, you put the whole load of shit on your significant other, who hasn't done a thing. I want to be honest with her. Do things right. Get serious. She's not going to forgive and forget. You tell her, and it's over. Is that what you want? I can't live the rest of my life wondering if she's going to find out. How is she going to find out? You're taking her out of the country. It's a big world out there. What are the chances of running into someone who, lo and behold, knows what went on? You got what? A handful of people in on the story, all of them on your payroll. I wouldn't sweat it if I were you. He turned and looked at her. I live with you all these years, and this is how you think. It's called common sense, using the old noggin, looking before you leap. It's a rationalization, finding a way to save your own skin at someone else's expense. It's not costing her anything. How's she gonna know? And that was the question she left him with. Last thing out of her mouth before he helped her carry her bags down to the car and watched her disappear down the drive. End of Lola. Over and done. Through the tinted windows of the limousine, the quality of the light changed, and he realized Tommaso had slowed at the mouth of the parking garage and was nosing the limo down the incline. Dante returned the report to his briefcase and idly watched the concrete walls slide by. Support posts, low ceiling, the exit ramp coming up on his right. Tommaso pulled to the curb next to the entrance to Macy's. The backside elevators to the office floors were located to the right, often unnoticed by shoppers as they passed the spot, intent on something else. Hubert got out on the passenger side and came around to the rear to open the door for him. As Dante emerged from the car, the elevator doors opened and a young woman stepped out. Dante took in the sight of her. Jeans, black turtleneck, and a big slouchy shoulder bag, with a curious sense of familiarity. It was unusual to see anyone in the parking garage at so early an hour. Hubert
shifted his weight automatically, blocking her access to his boss. The woman stopped, and Dante saw recognition flicker in her eyes as she looked from his big bodyguard to the limousine. Dante couldn't remember ever seeing her, but she seemed to know him. He was about to move past her when she spoke up. "Could I talk to you?"
"About what?" Hubert said. "Miss!"
"You're Lorenzo Dante. I was just in your office looking for you."
"Who are you?"
Hubert was saying,
"Please, miss, could you step away from the car?"
These were standard phrases he'd learned. Anyone hearing him would think he knew English well, but as it turned out, in his job, fluency wasn't required unless it came to guns and hand-to-hand combat, at which he was truly gifted.
"Hubert, would you cool it? I'm having a conversation here."
He said,
"Sorry, boss,"
but kept a watchful eye on the interchange. "I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm a friend of Pinky's."
"What's that have to do with me?"
"Last night, Pinky and your brother got into a shootout. And Pinky's wife was hit in the crossfire. She's in bad shape. And Pinky's worried sick about her medical bills."
"I'm not seeing the relevance."
"Pinky had a set of photographs to give you. Only your brother got there first and destroyed both the prints and the negatives."
"Photographs of what?"
"Cappy and Len Pretty chatting together in a parked car on 6 different occasions. Your brother sold you out." Dante stared at her for a moment while he decided what to do, and then he said,
"Get in."
He stood aside while she slung her shoulder bag into the back of the limousine and slid in after it, shifting both herself and her bag over to the long side seat. When she was settled, he ducked in and took his usual place. To Tommaso, he said,
"Take a drive. I'll tell you when it's time to bring us back."
Before Tommaso pulled away, he triggered the mechanism that closed the panel between the front seat and the rear of the car. By then, Hubert was back in the front seat. Dante was intent on the woman sitting to his left. She was somewhere in her 30s, more girl than woman as far as he was concerned. He couldn't decide what to make of her. She was small-boned, with a ragged mop of dark hair she must have chopped off herself. Hazel eyes, her nose ever so slightly crooked. He could tell she'd been banged up, but he couldn't imagine why. He said,
"How do you know Pinky? You don't look like the lowlife type."
"I'm a private eye. He gave me the first set of key picks I ever owned, and I owe him for that. I'm also fond of him, rascal that he is."
"And he hired you to do what?"
"Not him. The man engaged to Audrey Vance. He was getting it."
"You're the one who took my money and gave it to the cops. You and her landlady up in San Luis Obispo. That was a bad thing you did."
"Hey, you sent guys to break into my studio. You violated my privacy, and that's just as bad." He couldn't believe she had the nerve to sound indignant when she was the one who'd wronged him. He nearly smiled, but thought better of it.
"We're talking about $100,000 you cost me." She shrugged.
"The courier service handed it over to Audrey's landlady. Why am I to blame?"
"Wait a minute. Now I know where I heard your name. I read about you in the paper. You blew the whistle on Audrey."
"What was I supposed to do? I saw her steal underwear and stuff it in her bag."
"Could have looked the other way. Audrey was a peach. She worked for me for years. I'm surprised she wasn't better at her job." "You've also been following a friend of mine, and it's upsetting her. Where do you get off pulling shit like that?"
"Oh, right. Helping hearts, healing hands. That's a crock," she said. "You want to talk about Cappy or go on trading recriminations? You ask me, we're even."
"You got a hell of a nerve. Why'd you come to me with bullshit about Pinky? What the fuck do I care? The guy's a punk."
"He needs help. I thought maybe we could work a trade."
"A trade?"
"Sure. I'll tell you what I know, and you pay his medical bills and living expenses until Dodie's back on her feet." He stared at her with amazement.
"I'm a bad man, Didn't anybody tell you?
You don't seem bad to me.
I am not someone you come to with a deal, he said. That's the point.
She looked at him with, he wouldn't call it insolence, but maybe cockiness.
Why not?
Why not?
Take a look at the other players in this game. You tell me Cappy sold me out. You know what kind of a guy he is. A claim like that could get you killed. Len Pretty's worse.
Than Cappy?
How you figure?
Len's a cop, sworn to uphold the law. If he's corrupt, then what happens to the rest of us?
Oh, I see. You figure I'm corrupt to begin with, so what difference does it make?
Not at all. I suspect you play straight, and you're a man of your word.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that you have power, and you've had it for years. You don't need to dick around.
Nice talk. But it's not going to help. You've got nothing to trade. Cappy snitching is not exactly late-breaking news. I've been suspicious about him since he got out of Soledad.
Well, now you know for sure. I saw the photographs.
Your word against his. You said he destroyed them all, so where's your proof?
Doesn't matter. You won't be taking him to court, so the evidence is irrelevant.
Two corrections. A, you don't know what I'll do with him. And B, you don't have a clue what's relevant. Tell me something I don't know, and maybe we'll do business. Believe it or not, I'm fond of Pinky myself.
She held his gaze, and he could tell there was something more she wanted to say. She was debating the wisdom of it, and for the first time, he was truly interested.
Come on, out with it.
Are you aware Abby Upshaw is Len Pretty's girlfriend? He could feel his focus sharpen.
Says who?
I saw them at the Palms a week ago. That's how she was introduced. You can ask her yourself.
You saw her in my office.
Of course. I was looking for you when I ran into her.
And she's in on the deal, whatever it is, with these pictures you're talking about.
For starters, I think she took them. Len stashed them at her place. She was out of town last weekend, no doubt humping his bones. Pinky looked for the photographs at Len's, and when they didn't turn up, he decided to try her place. He walked away with her home safe, and when he drilled it, he hit pay dirt.
What's his stake in this?
Len was using another set of photographs to keep him in line. Those are the ones he was after at the time. The shots of Len and Cappy were a bonus. Dumb luck on his part. He was hoping you'd forgive his $2,000 debt in exchange for them. Dante took a moment to assimilate the information.
Fair enough, he said. You tell Pinky to come see me and I'll take care of him. You have a car?
I'm parked in the underground garage. Dante reached up and pressed a button on the console.
You can take us back now. We'll drop the lady at her car.
He took the elevator up. When the doors opened, he crossed to the reception area and paused at Abby's desk. Beautiful girl, no doubt about it, with that long, dark hair. Sometimes she wore it up, caught in an oversized tortoiseshell clip that looked like a set of spring-loaded teeth. Steady, responsible. A valuable employee. She was watching him carefully, trying to read his mood. Maybe it had occurred to her that he and the private eye might have crossed paths downstairs.
I have a job for you, he said,
his tone matter-of-fact. For me? Her warm olive complexion had taken on a gray cast, and he knew if he reached out and touched her hand, her fingers would be cold.
I need 2 first-class seats on a flight from LAX to Manila. I'll need a limousine to take us down to the airport.
Her face went blank as the request sank in. A frown created 2 parallel creases between her eyes. If she did that often, they'd be permanent.
Is this a problem? He asked.
I was wondering why you chose Manila.
I like the Philippines, okay?
She licked her lips as though her mouth had gone dry. When did you want to leave?
Thursday. Make it late so I can get in a full day's work. I'll be at the warehouse first thing. Have a limo pick us up at the house for the trip down to the airport. You don't want your driver to take you? He's entitled to 3 weeks paid vacation. I'm giving him the time off. Same with my bodyguard. She hesitated. Lou L. usually handles travel. And now you do. Think you can manage it?
Yes, sir.
He leaned down and pulled over the notepad where she recorded phone calls. He preferred a different system, one with automatic carbons, so the top slip could be torn off and left on his desk. He jotted two names and a series of numbers on a lined page and pushed it back to her. She glanced down. Mrs. Vogelsang? You have an opinion. You can keep it to yourself. Won't I need her birth date and passport number? He pointed. What do you think that is?
Oh, sorry. What airline?
Surprise me. I want the itinerary in hand by the end of the day. Also, call the police department and ask to speak to Sergeant Detective Priddy. That's Priddy. Set up a meeting here as soon as possible, within the hour if you can make it. He crossed to the door and pushed into the inner corridor without looking back. But he could picture her dismay. What would she do with Len Priddy in the office? Admit she was in bed with the vice cop? Pretend she didn't know the guy? He stopped in Luell's office and found her tapping on her computer keys, her glasses low on her nose. Sorry to interrupt. I've asked Abby to book some airline tickets. I don't want you to think she's treading on your turf. Appreciate the information. Anything else? That's what I like about you. All business. That's what you pay me for. Who do we know at St. Terry's? Medical records or administration? You tell me. I need everything they got on these two. Again, he jotted information on a scratch pad, tore off the leaf, and passed it to her. He continued writing while Luell read the note he'd given her. Pierpont? That's a good one. I didn't name the guy. His mother did. Set up an account in his name. $100,000 for starters. We'll see how it goes from there. You make sure he's taken care of, regardless. Her gaze came up to his. Regardless of what? Life's a crapshoot. You never know what's coming down the pike. Is this deductible? He smiled. Good question. Talk to Saul and see if he can make it work, he said. As long as you're at it, there's something else you need to set up. A little switcheroo. He handed her the second piece of scratch paper. She glanced at it.
Ooh, for me?
I thought you and your hubby could use the time away. She folded the note in half and slipped it under her desk calendar.
Thanks.
Very sporting of you. I'll let Saul know about the rest of it since it's his department, he said. Everything is Saul's department. Understood. He spent the rest of the morning taking care of odds and ends. When Abby buzzed him at noon, he'd almost forgotten what he wanted until she told him Sergeant Priddy was in the lobby. Give him a few minutes and then bring him in. It won't hurt him to cool his heels.
Would you like coffee?
Why not? Make the guy feel welcome. He took his finger off the intercom. No reason to chafe about Abby's deception. People did you in. People turned on you in a heartbeat. Pop always told him it was like that. His advice was to play the hand you're dealt. No point wishing things were different, just because the truth cut you as clean as a razor blade. He got up from his desk and crossed to the wall safe, ran the combination, and opened it. He put his Sig Sauer in the inner pocket of his sport coat. When he sat down again, he buzzed Abby and told her she could bring Priddy in. A few minutes passed before the two arrived. If he'd had a surveillance camera in the lobby, he might have been entertained by their shenanigans. She tapped on his door, and as she opened it, he reached forward and pressed a button on the answering machine. She and Priddy had apparently decided to play it cool. She kept her expression bland and indifferent, and Len made a point of ignoring her.
Dante got up and shook Len's hand, inviting him to take a seat. He'd never liked the guy's looks. Something smarmy going on. His hair was a slick gray, combed back from his face, which was big and square. His skin was crepey, with an unbecoming puffiness along his jaw. He had bags under his eyes, and his upper lid sagged until it was a marvel he could see. He couldn't imagine what a gorgeous girl like Abby was doing with a guy like him. Maybe she needed a sugar daddy, and he got off being sexually serviced by someone half his age. Dante said, "Sergeant Detective Pretty, it's nice to see you again. It's been a while."
"You seem to be holding your own," Len said.
"I was, until recently."
"Oh?"
"Yeah. Oh. Let's cut to the chase here. My brother's been seen in conversation with you. I've heard it from more than one source, and it doesn't sit well." Len continued to look at him. Dante could see that he was reluctant to confirm the claim and too smart to deny it. Len said, "I'm not sure this is a conversation we should be having."
"Why not?
The place isn't bugged. I have it swept every other day," Dante said, and went on. "I imagine you've come into all manner of information about how I run my business. Not that Cappy's a reliable source."
"I don't think that warrants comment. You know your brother better than I do.
Here's something he hasn't been told, and therefore hasn't had the opportunity to pass along. I'm closing up shop. I've been meaning to get out for years, but it was never the right time." Len smiled.
"You're closing up shop because you're under indictment and you know you're going to jail."
"I wasn't aware we were discussing my motivation," Dante said. "I admit my retirement is self-serving, but keep this in mind. I'm a good businessman. I believe in sound financial practices, the same as a bank. I've also kept the violence to a minimum, and what there was of it was Cappy's doing."
"You've never ordered a hit," Len said facetiously.
"No, I have not. Killing makes for bad public relations. Not that Cappy would agree. He can hardly wait to step into my shoes. Once that happens, you got a real problem on your hands."
"I think I can deal with it."
"The deal is the issue we're here to discuss. He might be willing to slip you your share, but he won't be as generous as I've been. You'd be wise to broker an agreement up front, and make sure it's on your terms, not his."
"Is that what this meeting's about? Unsolicited advice from a fucking gangster?"
"I don't think of myself as a gangster. The term offends me. I've never been convicted of a crime."
"You will be.
You're entitled to feel smug because you win either way. I'm out, he's in, it's all the same to you. You think you've got your hands full with me? Wait until Cappy's in the driver's seat. He'll turn this town on its ear."
"So why don't you do us all a favor and get rid of him?" Len said.
Dante smiled. "Why don't you? I've got enough problems as it is without adding murder to the list."
"You only have one problem, buddy. We are taking you down."
"Oh, please. How long has this investigation been going on? 2 years? 3? You're playing patty cake with the FBI and who else? DEA? ATF? All government grunts, a bunch of jack-offs." "I already told you I'm out of here. Cappy's the one you should worry about. Take him out, and the business is all yours." Len got up.
"Meeting's over. Goodbye and good luck. Think about it. That's all I'm saying. Retire from the PD and live in style for a change. You could do a lot worse."
"I'll take it under advisement," he said. "What's the time frame for this departure of yours?"
"That's no concern of yours.
I'm telling you this much because I want to be fair, since you've been such a help to me." Dante left the office early. He was restless, obsessing about Nora, trying to decide what to do. He wanted to tell her what happened to Philip, but he knew it would be the end of their relationship. On the other hand, What was love about if not honesty and openness? He had Tommaso drop him at the house, where he picked up his car. He drove to the Vogelsangs in Montebello and swung the Maserati into the courtyard, then parked it next to Nora's Thunderbird. It was Wednesday, and he assumed Channing was back in Los Angeles. Dante was heavy-hearted, a phrase he'd never understood before. He crossed to the front door, aware of how ordinary all of his actions felt. He was playing the part of Lorenzo Dante, not fully inhabiting his body, but removed as though watching from outside himself. She must have heard his car pull in, because when he rang the bell, she opened the door. Her face was stone. She held on to the door, forcing him to remain outside. Someone had spilled the beans. Who told you? Two FBI agents came to the house in Malibu. I can't believe you didn't tell me yourself. How long were you going to let this go on? I had no idea you were married to Tripp until yesterday at the beach house. Yes, you did. I saw it in your face. Why didn't you speak up? I couldn't. When it finally dawned on me, all I could think was I didn't want to lose you. I knew if I owned up, it was over. Nora said, "You're despicable. I didn't mean to deceive you. I came here because I want to be straight with you, whatever the cost." "Well, aren't you the noble one?" "Nora, God's truth. I never laid a hand on your boy. I'm not excusing myself. He died because of me. I'm responsible, but not through any intention on my part. I made an offhand remark, and Cappy took it for something else. He's vicious, and he has no impulse control. He's been that way since he was a kid. I should have had him taken out. I couldn't bring myself to do it, but I should have done it anyway. I didn't understand how dangerous he was." "Yes, you did. You knew perfectly well, but you looked the other way." "I don't want to argue with you. That's not why I'm here. You're right. Whatever you say, I accept. I should have turned him in 2 years ago when I found out he threw Philip off that roof. I thought his being my brother mattered more than justice. I was wrong. You could have turned him in yesterday. I might have believed in your sincerity if you'd done that. I'll make it right. I'll talk to the DA and tell him everything. Who gives a shit what you do now? He's still your brother. I don't see why you should suddenly see your way clear to doing what you should have done long before now. Listen to me. Listen. All bets are off. Cappy sold me out to the cops, and that's the end of anything I owe him." "Are you hearing yourself? You're saying if he'd been loyal, you'd have gone on protecting him. So what if he killed a few people? You'd have shielded him as long as there was some benefit to you. I carried him because Pop would have died if anything happened to him. I thought if I looked after him, my old man would eventually bring me in out of the cold." "Oh, you're out in the cold, all right. Fine. I'm out. I won't fight you on this. As long as we're putting our cards on the table, there's something else. You do whatever you have to do. But fold this into the equation while you're at it. Philip was a good kid, but he was off track. He told me he gambled all through college. He bragged he made money at it, but that was bullshit. All poker players say that. It's a distortion, filtering out the losses and exaggerating the wins. Did you ever stop and calculate how much you and Channing paid out to cover his debts? You'd be paying to this day because he would never have given it up. He couldn't. That was his fix. How he took care of whatever pain and anxiety he felt. You don't know what you're talking about." "Yes, I do. I see guys like him all day long. I lend them money so they can try to bail themselves out of whatever hole they've dug. You and Channing were always going to be picking up after him. He was weak. How dare you criticize my son? He was a child, 23 years old. Nora, he had big problems. He was up and down, immature, grandiose, which was fine as long as he lived in the bubble he created for himself. But in the real world, he was floundering. How do you know he wouldn't have straightened out? He lost any chance he had.
He lost his life. And for what?
Maybe he would have straightened up. I don't know that, and neither do you. He didn't deserve to die. What happened to him was my fault, and I don't deny the part I played. I know you can't forget.